Well, welcome back as we head into hour three. Since it's Monday, we are privileged and honored once again, delighted to have with us Brandon Weikert. He is the author of several books. He writes for the National Interest. And usually when he's out of town, he joins us, which is the opposite of what I say about most of our regular guests. When he's in town, he can't join us. We had that experience, didn't we, Brandon?
Yes, unfortunately.
We had him come into Arizona, but flights were diverted and it couldn't work out. So there's this issue between Brandon and I where the gods of radio and public policy are trying to prevent us from ever actually meeting. We've been dear friends for, I don't know, how long now, Brandon? 6-7 years?
And
we've never actually
2018.
Met.
It's pretty yeah, funny. Since 2018.
I think so, yeah, if you think
yeah.
about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, listen, there's a lot to do. Let me give you your credentials appropriately. Author of several books, including Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. He is the author of The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, Biohacked, China's Race to Control Life. And later this year, couldn't be more relevant, coming out a book called A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine. Maybe I'll start there because I saw, Brandon, actually article in the Washington Examiner you retwixed from someone, a writer named Mike Brest. Now that Ukraine
yeah.
aid has passed, what does success look like in the eyes of the administration? One of the interesting things is when asked, Defense Department officials, including the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, they don't have a clear answer to that question. What does success look like? They don't even really talk in terms, really, of success, do they?
No, this reminds me of something my colleague many, many years ago, George Friedman, once said about the Iraq War, in which he said that, well, America is so wealthy and powerful, it doesn't have to win that war. It just has to stop Al-Qaeda from winning. It just doesn't have to lose to Al-Qaeda.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I always thought that was a horrible, yeah. horrible way to look at you know, a war in which Americans were fighting. Now we have in Ukraine, obviously, the Americans who are in Ukraine are not technically fighting, and those that are fighting are not actually American troops. They are volunteers. But the bottom line is we have millions of people whose lives are being eviscerated by this war that we are helping to prolong with this aid. And the fact of the matter is nobody in D.C. or Brussels or London or Kyiv, for that matter, has a clear-cut strategy for how you take this gobs of U.S. taxpayer money and all this NATO equipment and you convert it into a win. They don't have a solution. They don't have a strategy, and it's just prolonging the war, which is actually paradoxically weakening the Western alliance and empowering the Russians, because we're seeing the Russians are adapting to this very difficult situation far better than either the Ukrainians or their NATO partners are able to adapt. And obviously in warfare, like, you know, living in the, you know, the wild, the side that can adapt to the environment the best, the quickest, wins. And the Russians, as brutal as they are and as hard of a time as they've had at the beginning of the war, really, you know, getting what they want out of the war, they have over the long term started adapting, and you're seeing that play out now.
Brandon, I don't know if I'm right to say that I could see Ukraine losing, assuming, you know,
money's lost.
Dry up and defense materiel stops flowing in. Can Russia lose?
Russia has not lost the eastern or southern Crimea territories, and so a defeat for Russia would be not just the loss of those eastern Russian-speaking provinces that they've held for decades, but it would be the loss of Crimea, specifically their port in Sevastopol, which they have had since Catherine the Great, you know, built the naval base at Sevastopol. And so a loss for Russia is the loss of physical loss of those territories, and there is absolutely no way Ukraine, and I've said this since the start of the war, there's no way that the Ukrainian army is ever going to be able to evict the Russians from those entrenched positions. And as it turns out, they have not been able to. The Ukrainians, in my opinion, have already lost the war. The war is already over. It's just that Western aid is now preventing the final hammer from falling, which, of course, would be the end of Ukraine as we know it. But the bottom line is Ukraine, under no circumstance, will ever be able to win without direct NATO military intervention. And God help us if that happens, because I can tell you this much right now. If that does, in fact, happen, especially if there are U.S. troops that are officially introduced into Western Ukraine, which it looks like that's what might be happening soon, then we are in a true world war with Russia. And they will not hesitate to use nuclear weapons to protect their holdings in Sevastopol.
Do you think that that this was a calculation for the long term by Russia or for the short term? In other words, from what you know of Russian history and geopolitical strategy, do you think Putin thought he could wear us out the way Bin Laden thought he could wear us out or wear our allies out, and that, you know, success will come, it just won't come in a year? Do you think Ukraine thought the opposite?
I think that, and, you know, we talked about this at the beginning of the war, and of course I said back then, and I still say, Russia should not have invaded Ukraine. That Ukraine was the aggrieved party, and they had a right to self-defense, and we were right to help them protect the Western free portion of Ukraine. Where the problem with the war, you know, went was after they defended Kyiv about a year and a half ago, suddenly that's when, you know, Ukraine thought, hey, we can take the whole country back. And, of course, that wasn't going to happen. And that was where they erred. But, you know, the Russians, I think right now, pretty much for the last year and a half, I think the Russian goal has actually been much more limited than what Putin had envisioned it to be at the beginning of the conflict. The Russian goal right now is one of hanging on. Okay. The Russian goal right now is we just really, at the end of the day, want the Russian-speaking east of Ukraine, and we want Crimea. Now, if we can get more, great, but that's not, I think, the primary goal here. I think the primary goal is to neutralize the Ukrainian government so that it's no longer a viable NATO member, plus hold on to those eastern Russian-speaking provinces and Crimea. Anything beyond that is gravy, and Putin's not going to break his back for it. The Americans, on the other hand, I think have had zero long-term strategic thought on this issue from the beginning. I think the American administration, the Biden administration, all they care about right now, the reason they push so hard for this aid package right now the way they did, is because 6 months from now there is a major election, and the last thing Biden can afford is officially having an L in Ukraine for Team NATO. So he would rather prolong the suffering so as to get through November so that there is no collapse. There's just no victory either for Ukraine. They just sort of keep kind of limping on. And that for Biden is as far as he's thinking, his team. Of course, he's not thinking of anything because he's brain dead. But his team, this is their calculation, is just get through the election and then we'll reassess. But that, you know, there's been no long-term thought process here at all. If there was a real long-term thought process, it would have been, hey, we successfully defended Kyiv a year and a half ago. That's the prize. So now's the time to get our partner Zelensky to negotiate with Russia for a peace deal when he has the upper hand. And by the way, that's what Zelensky was trying to do with the Istanbul conference. And it was Boris Johnson, when he was PM of Britain, along with Joe Biden, who basically strong-armed Zelensky to say, you better not do any deal after you succeeded in defending Kyiv. You now need to go on the offensive and somehow manage to beat the entire Russian army, which has been entrenched in eastern Ukraine and Crimea for over a decade.
You know, you put your finger on a few of these things that I wanted to tie this segment up on before we moved on to other issues. But it always felt to me from the beginning, when did Russia invade? Early 22, February of 22,
February,
I think.
February 22.
Yeah. It always felt to me like Joe Biden was using this as a political effort. When that
Absolutely.
State of the Union came out, and then you remember all the virtue signaling and all the Ukraine flags, you don't hear him talk about it at all. All the Ukraine flags seem to have disappeared. They've been replaced
Except
by Hamas flags,
day.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. But let me come back on that and the political nature when we come back from this quick commercial break. Brandon J. Weichert is my guest. Brandon Weichert writes for The National Interest, other publications. Follow him on Twitter, X, Twix, at We The Brandon. We The Brandon. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Brandon Weikert is my guest. Going to cover a lot here, but let me finish with Brandon on a few thoughts on Russia and Ukraine. Brandon, it felt to me the dedication of the first, third or so of his State of the Union in 2022, Joe Biden made such an issue of Ukraine and Russia. People seemed to fall along. I almost got the feeling he was trying to unite the country around another country. It was a weird calculation, I thought, but it seemed pretty evident to me that that's what he was trying to do, find something to unite the country on. And it petered out, and they didn't have any stick-to-itiveness with it. And Joe Biden started saying really stupid things that his staff had to correct him on. And so the whole effort seemed to disappear into muddiness, the opposite of clarity. In a fairly clear-to-understand situation, with countries not a lot of people think an awful lot about, and perhaps it's asking Americans too much to focus on that kind of thing when we have so many problems here. But you do not hear Biden or the administration talking much about it anymore. For a while, it was all they could talk about.
Well, we don't talk about it because, as I said before, the Ukraine war is lost. Okay. Ukrainians have lost the war. The war is over. It's just that the Western aid is basically keeping that last little top of the sinking ship from going totally under, and that's where all the survivors are kind of standing around clinging for dear life, hoping that it doesn't go totally underwater. As for Biden, his intentions with Ukraine, it was very obvious to me from the beginning that he fancied himself, or his people, his wife, fancied the Biden presidency as being as momentous in progressivism as was Woodrow Wilson's presidency, FDR's presidency, and LBJ's presidency. And all three of those men have one thing in common. Not only did they have these sweeping domestic, anti-constitutional, unconstitutional programs, but they also had major wars to kind of keep people on their side. And I think the Biden people thought, hey, Ukraine is perfect because it's a major war against our great enemy, Russia. And we can rally the country there. But guess what? We don't have to really have any American boots on the ground like George W. Bush did in Iraq. So we get the best of both worlds. They didn't realize that, A, most Americans don't care about this, and B, guess what? Ukraine isn't as wonderful as they're saying it is. It isn't Churchill's Great Britain. It's a corrupt, kleptocratic nation. Zelensky was trying to fix things. Zelensky was a reformer. But it looks more and more like he has been increasingly co-opted by those very same corrupt elements that he was elected to get rid of because he needs to survive. He has to survive in that system. And in that war situation, he doesn't have a choice. He's got to make peace with these radical elements in his own camp to keep the war going. So it's a very sloppy, messy situation. I've had many generals tell me, oh, you don't understand what's going on. We're breaking the Russian army in the field for cheap. And I have to tell you, no, we're not. Actually, what we're doing is we're radicalizing Russia. We're forcing Russia into the waiting arms of China. Oh, and by the way, we're also revitalizing Russia's defense industrial base, as our defense industrial base can't seem to keep up with the increased demand.
What's interesting about this to me, and I maybe said it without thinking too clearly about when I said it in the previous segment, when I said, the Ukraine flags that used to be everywhere have been taken down and maybe in some ways replaced by Palestinian flags in the virtue signal mode of our times. It is odd that the people Biden was trying to rally behind Ukraine seem to be so ardently supportive of the Hamas position with the Palestinians. If you're anti-Russia, you would theoretically be against the group that Russia is helping fund or helping transfer military equipment to, which is, in this case, Hamas. We don't think that way. I guess our youth don't think that way. Maybe they don't think at all. I don't know.
Well, it isn't just our youth. We have very senior people in the Democratic Party who are saying this as well.
Yeah.
And that's because ultimately Ukraine, and let's just get real, Ukraine ultimately isn't even about reliving the best days of World War II. It isn't about Captain America versus, the Russians. This is about money laundering. This is about whatever nefarious dark thing we had going on in Ukraine for decades. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, you had Hunter Biden at the epicenter of it. Of course, you're not allowed to talk about this anymore. And then all of the people in D.C. who were benefiting financially from what is basically a giant money laundering scheme in Ukraine, those same people, ideologically, though, are anti-Israel. So in that context, the only reason they're really for Ukraine is twofold. First, they want to get their cut of the action. Second, it's against Russia, and most of these people believe or have helped to perpetuate the lie that Trump and the Republicans stole the 2016 election from Hillary Clinton on behalf of Vladimir Putin. So in some weird way, this is revenge for the Democrats against Putin, against the Republicans, etc. But supporting Hamas, supporting Hezbollah, supporting Iran, that actually makes perfect sense because ideologically, spiritually, that's where the Democrats are. So when we hear them talk about Ukraine and their right to exist and the human rights, just remember, it's probably not sincere. It's probably more about money and revenge. Meanwhile, the same group that is lecturing us about human rights in Ukraine and saving Ukrainian democracy is the exact same group that is empowering Hamas, which is basically an anti-Semitic Nazi organization masquerading as a religious movement.
What explains to you, I mean, you and I have always, I think it's fair for me to say this of you, feel free to disagree or set the record straight. I have always thought, I think like you, that the campus is important, that higher education, whether it's important to send your child through it or not is a different equation. But what happens on the college, what campuses stand for and do matters. I've always thought that. I thought it was a major centrifuge of our cultural and political.
And it was a mistake for the Republicans and the right to abandon it.
There you go. Yeah, for certain, it was K through 12 education.
Absolutely.
Right. And I don't know.
Luckily, we have men like Chris Rufo who are trying to help.
Yes. There's a handful.
Yeah.
There were warning signs in the 80s. That were issued on this stuff, that once we got rid of Western civilization curricula and the canon, that we would start esteeming things that aren't so Western. That is to say, organizations and movements that are misogynistic at best, transfer the term or euphemize the term terrorism with liberation, that do not understand reliable standards of human rights. Yes, yes, the human condition. All of that. When the Western Civ courses went out and the attack on Western Civ was high, I'd like your thoughts if you think this is the dividend we are seeing when we come back. Would you perhaps speak a little bit?
Yeah.
And if it is or isn't, what is animating this nonsense? I'll leave you with this quote before I go to the commercial break. I can't get out of my head what one person said. Watching an LGBTQ protest for the Palestinians, she goes, I see a lot of that. I don't see any Palestinian protests for LGBTQ rights. That's kind of the point we're making. We'll be right back. Back to the Seth Leibson Show. We're coming into the song Mrs. Robinson, which was emblematic of the 1967 movie The Graduate. Brendan, I have you ever seen The Graduate?
Oh, yes, I have, of course.
One of the interesting things is it's 1967. He gets on the Berkeley campus. You've never seen a more quiet, tranquil, peaceful campus in your life. You know it's fiction at that point. And God wishes the campuses today looked like they did then. But the campuses did light themselves on fire in the late 60s. Yeah. They're lighting themselves on fire now. And it's on behalf of really one of the most medieval notions, and I'm trying to wrap my head around how these kids can. I think they're either entitled, stupid, or ideologically fanatical. Sometimes all three, but usually one of those three. I don't know what your explanation is.
My explanation is it's evil. It's just pure evil. We're dealing with varying iterations. You know, I've said it before, you know, Joseph Campbell had his theory, the hero with a thousand.
Oh, the hero's journey. Yeah, right. Hero of a thousand faces.
I have
right.
my iteration right. for right. when we talk about these things about politics today. I call it the villain with a thousand faces.
Okay.
It's evil. You know, whether we're talking about what are really basically anti-Semitic, you know, pogroms in these campuses or you know, quasi pogroms, or we're talking about the Democratic Party's, you know, willingness to let millions of Ukrainians be slaughtered so that they can move money around in Ukraine and move weapons around in Ukraine to kind of get revenge on Vladimir Putin for a completely made up thing, the Russia collusion thing. It's all evil. We're dealing with evil, evil, evil. And there's absolutely, with the exception maybe of Donald Trump and people like Ron DeSantis, there aren't many people in powerful Republican positions who seem willing to stop it, who seem willing to say, this is not acceptable and we are going to fight it. Now, I mentioned Chris Rufo. He's one of the guys. He's not elected, but he's a very powerful person on our side who has decided to basically save K through 12 schooling and probably the campus as well. But it's a handful of lights in a sea of darkness. And sometimes that's all it takes. And so, you know, that's fine. But the bottom line is we're dealing with evil. That is what this is. It cannot be negotiated with. You cannot compromise with it. All you can do is defeat it. Now, in this case, it's defeating it in the arena of ideas. But you have to defeat it. And you can't. There's, you know, AOC is not interested in negotiation, nor is Chuck Schumer. We always used to say, well, Schumer is, you know, he's older, he's been around, he understands. But Schumer, about a month ago, made these weird anti-Israeli comments, which was really quite shocking for me as somebody who worked on the Hill and knew Schumer and what kind of where he came from. I was surprised about a month ago he made these comments in which he basically was saying Israel doesn't have the right to defend itself. So if even Schumer is turning on Israel even a little bit, it should tell you how far gone the Democrats are, which leads me to the conclusion that we are not dealing with rational, sane people who want to just get compromise in order to, you know, rising tide lifting all boats. These are people who hate us. They are driven by an animus and a malice toward all things decent. And you can't negotiate with them. You just have to defeat them at the ballot box.
Would you have the students arrested by the police?
Oh, I would. Furthermore, I love what they're doing in France. I don't know if you saw this. It's on Twitter right now. There's a video of the, I think it's in Paris, the French police, the gendarmerie or whatever.
Yeah,
going
the gendarme, right.
And sicking dogs on these anti-Israeli protesters, which is quite telling because, you know, France is not necessarily a safe haven for pro-Israeli thought. But they are trying to clear up their campuses and they're using police force to do it with dogs. And so, you know, I think we should I think we should be, you know, beating up some hippies here.
Let me tell you what I think, because I think I have a compromise that might work a little bit in respect of all these students and faculty that don't think that the police have a right to enter the campus. I'm willing to say that with them. Let's take the police off the table. I believe that when you look at what SGP and the other materiel and speakers are using and saying and promoting, that we have pretty good case for material support for terrorism, Hamas particularly, PFLP being on the Al-Aqsa brigades being on the terrorism watch list. Let's not send in the police. Let's send in the FBI. We're supposed to say something when we see something. We aren't
That's
seeing something. We're being
Mar-a-Lago.
Blinded by it.
That's only if you're at Mar-a-Lago.
Hold the thought. Right. Hold the thought. Right. Yes. The FBI are very good at that. Not so much about the terrorism issue. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Brendan Weikert has been my guest and is my guest. And this is what's kind of I keep coming back to, Brendan. You were kind of putting words to it on the way to the break. It's not hypocrisy, it's not double standards, because those arguments just seem to mean nothing anymore. It's something glaring, and it's Joe Biden's whole calling card for his run for the presidency in 2020 in his announcement speech and about 20 times since then. And he's talked about the whole reason he decided to run was when he saw the riots in Charlottesville in 2017 and the vile anti-Semitism of the marchers with their veins bulging. That's his packaged phrase. He knew he had to run. Try and find the arrest records of what took place at Charlottesville. Try and find how many people were arrested or how many showed. It's a very hard number to find. It's far less than 100. It may not be 50 as far as arrests go. Over the last 4 days, 900 people have been arrested on our college campuses. 900. He goes to New York. He went to New York Friday, which is the center of this storm, I guess. And all he could do was fundraisers and Howard Stern. And a little both sidesism. It's to say that this administration, I think, has totally lost its moral compass and given a broken compass to the far left. That's what I think has happened here.
I think it's worse than that. It isn't lost a moral compass. Their moral compass is clearly inverted. I was in college, probably 15 years ago, and I had a lot of run-ins with the Students for Justice in Palestine. I was the DePaul College Republican president. Actually, we were featured on Jon Stewart's Daily Show because we were one of the leading voices fighting to prevent SJP from banning Sabra hummus on our campus. Sabra hummus.
I forgot about that.
So that was one of my big fights. And I remember I pulled aside the head of SJP and I was talking to her and I was like, you don't honestly, like, why do you care? It's a delicious food. Why are you wasting all of our time? And she looked at me and there were no cameras. There was no one public. And she told me it's because it's made with the blood of Palestinian children.
Yeah.
And I looked at her and I realized this individual really believes.
They really believe that, don't they? They truly do.
They do. And so in their opinion, in their worldview, they're fighting fascism and Nazism and, you know, all this stuff. So Biden is just a natural outgrowth of that. This isn't a lost moral compass. This is an inverted moral compass, which is why I said this is evil you're dealing with. You're not dealing with a group of people who just are lost. You're dealing with a group of people who are so fixated in their beliefs that their beliefs are the exact opposite of what we know to be good and true. Okay, that's the thing. That's how you know you're fighting against evil, when they believe firmly in what simply isn't so. And that is the danger of a Biden second term. That is the danger of a resurgent Democratic Party. That is the danger we face if Biden is reelected. This really is it for America, because if that man gets into office again, let me tell you something, it's going to be no holds barred. You think it's bad now? He is going to go full bore with all of these socialist, anti-American, anti-Semitic policies, and America in another 4 years will be unrecognizable.
CNN has a poll out this morning saying 61% of Americans say Joe Biden's presidency is a failure. Gallup has a poll out showing Joe Biden is the least popular president in 70 years. You could add yours and my life together and not get 70 years, probably. Maybe. No, that's probably not. Yeah, maybe. But the point I guess I'm asking is, with so much failure on its watch, the Biden administration, and it's lost, yes, or broken, with so much failure on its watch, if you're going into November, what side would you rather be on right now if you had $1 million riding on it?
Well, that's the big question here, because the issue is, will we have a clean election? And I don't know. And the other issue is, are people willing to look the other way on Trump's negatives to say, you know what, this guy may be a vulgarian, as Ann Coulter calls him, but you know what, he actually had great policies. He was actually a pretty decent president, all things considering, compared to Biden especially. So I'm going to hold my nose and vote for this guy. The upside for Trump right now, if it is a clean election, even with everything he's going through, in the six out of the seven key swing states that will determine this election, Trump is up by multiple points over Biden, and it's getting worse every month for Biden. And if this continues, there is no way Biden will win re-election, which is why I think the left are losing it. And so if I had $1 million, maybe I'm biased, I would say I would get behind Trump. I think Trump is going to be the guy if it's a clean election. Again, big F. But if it is a clean election, he's going to be the guy that wins, and thank God. But I hope he picks the right vice president. You know, it looks like it's going to be Marco Rubio. I don't really think that's the greatest pick, only because Rubio has surrounded himself with some of those Bush people that we really don't want to have around again. I think a DeSantis would be a much better pick, you know, since we're talking about apparently the 12th Amendment issue is not really that big of an issue. I got into it with somebody over the weekend. You have to remember, yes, Trump and DeSantis, or Trump and Rubio, are both Florida citizens and technically can't run together on a ticket. But as Dick Cheney proved in 2000, all you have to do is change your residency last minute, and it's not an issue. So, or at least it shouldn't be. So with that being said, I think that if he gets the right vice president, I think he can win, and I think this country can be saved. But if, you know, he picks the wrong person, if it's not a clean election, you know, it's going to, and if a lot of people don't want to say they voted for Trump because they're embarrassed by it, because he's mean, and they vote for Biden by default, that could be a big problem. But it doesn't look like that's going to be a factor. So I would say Trump is the guy.
I wonder if, it's interesting how these Florida representatives, or, well, Florida office holders, DeSantis and Rubio have become the names of the moment, the speculated names of the moment. I for some time thought possibly Tim Scott. I guess Kristi Noem has taken herself out.
There's no way that woman is ever going to get anywhere near the White
House. Not now,
is
it?
Killing puppies.
No, not now. Let me
now, look. If she was pro-abortion, she'd have a better chance.
Yes.
Okay, but killing puppies is a bridge too far, I guess.
I don't even know what she was thinking. There's something weird there in doing it and then strutting about it.
Well, Seth, I've heard things about her. That
Right. Well, Brandon, I love hearing from you directly, and I thank you. These Mondays are very important to me and the audience. Bless you, sir.
Well, thank you.
You betcha. You too. Have a great week, and we'll be in touch as needs be.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Brandon Weicker. Portions of this show brought to you by our dear friends at Y Refi. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's the word invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-Y-REFI. 24. YRefi is offering up an investment in a secure and collateralized portfolio that really invests you with control and flexibility. With YRefi, there are absolutely no fees. With YRefi, you can take income, you can turn your income off, you can compound it, whatever you like. With YRefi, you have peace of mind. There is no attack on principal. If you ever need your money back, of course you get a monthly statement with no surprises. But best of all, you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the stock market. Check them out at investyrefi.com. Invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI24, 888-YREFI24. I stumbled upon a quote that I wanted to share with you all last week, something to contemplate, maybe talk about more tomorrow as we have more time. And it's from Hilaire Belloc, and someone who I've gotten to know of more in the last few years. Boy, I don't know if you're like me. I think I've learned more in the last, I mean, it's not possibly true because it can't be, but it feels like I may have learned more in the last 3 to 5 years than I've learned in my first 50 years of life. Do any of you in the audience feel that way? Do you feel like, young David, do you feel like you've learned more in the last year or two than you did in your first 20 years? I don't know. It's just weird that way to me lately. Anyway, Hilaire Belloc said this: "We sit by and watch the barbarian. We tolerate him. In the long stretches of peace, we are not afraid. We are tickled by his irreverence, his comic inversion of our old certitudes and our fixed creeds refreshes us. We laugh. But as we laugh, we are watched by a large and awful face from beyond. And on that face, there is no smile. Think about that when we were being so dismissive of what was going on the college campuses throughout the 80s, the 90s, the early and mid-aughts, and just kind of dismissing these Marxists that our children and grandchildren and friends, students, college students were quoting. It was easy. They could quote barbarians in the long stretch of peace, and we weren't afraid. We were tickled by the barbarians' irreverence. But we were laughing, and we were being watched by a large and awful face. And on that face, there is no smile. Folks, thanks for spending some of your afternoon with us, starting your week with us. Till tomorrow, God bless you all. On behalf of David, Mr. Bill, and Terry, I'm Seth, and class dismissed.